everyone, I'm Colin Ellis, best-selling author, award-winning public speaker, and facilitator of global workplace culture change. And in this, the Culture Makers podcast, I get people managers from around the world to share actionable things that you can do too to create a great place to work. I hope you enjoy the show. It's Colin here. Welcome to another Culture Makers podcast. And today I'm delighted to be, as I always am, delighted to be joined by Danny Donoghue. It'd be interesting if I started a show. It's like, oh God, guess who's on the show today?
It'd make people really want to listen, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's like, why would we listen to this? Well, he's not delighted to have this guy on and not listening to that. Yes, delighted to be joined by Danny Donoghue. Now, Danny helps individuals and organisations to achieve peak performance in sports. A former professional footballer, Danny had to retire as a result of injury and has dedicated himself to helping others instead. He was part of the medical and sports science teams at Sunderland, Everton and Aston Villa before establishing his own practice, Embodyism, to help transform the lives and performance of athletes. He is also the co-founder of The Team Code, whose vision is to transform the culture in global sports. And he joins me today in a co-working space in a basement in Highbury and Islington. Hello, Danny.
Who's the other co-founder?
Oh, the other co-founder. We'll get to that.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so we're in this co-working space in Highbury. Unfortunately, the people who are next door have just left because I was just doing a session with a Premier League footballer and I was getting him to be really quiet and do some breath work. And they were so noisy. Luckily, they've gone now.
So, luckily, they've gone. Yeah. So you may hear some slight echo from the room. You may hear some what sounded like drilling the floor upstairs. But that shouldn't detract from the quality of the conversation.
Absolutely.
Hopefully. So thank you, Danny, for doing this. I really appreciate it. And so let's start from the beginning, which is a very good place to start, as the song goes, in terms of you working for yourself. So obviously, professional football played a big part in your life. Dad was a professional footballer. Was it something, and pressure's not probably the right word, but is it something that you felt that because you grew up in that space that that's something that you wanted to do?
Yeah, pressure's definitely not the right word because my dad is an amazing guy and he's the guy that puts the least pressure on you as a person, and I appreciate that so much. But I did have a very, very strong desire to be a footballer. Mm. It was all I wanted to do when I was young, and I practiced all day, every day. And as my kids now laugh, say, oh, you kicked the ball against the wall, did you? I actually did.
Yeah. That's what we did then. Yeah. That's all we had. Yeah.
But the other thing about my dad was he was a player and then he was a coach. And both of those parts of his lives, he wanted to get better. So I saw that firsthand. And we had people who would come and stay at the house, like movement gurus, physios, all kinds of experts to help him get a little bit better. So that kind of performance improvement mindset has been in me from birth. And then when he became a coach, I had bunk beds in my bedroom, and quite often there'd be a 16 stone footballer sleeping on my top bunk bed because he was overweight and he had to come and stay at our house for 2 weeks so my dad could teach him what to eat, how to breathe, how to live. God. So for 2 weeks they'd lose a lot of weight and then they'd put it all back on again.
Got back home. We're recording this just before Christmas and it's a traditional time here in England where we overeat and overdrink, so I may have to go and stay at your dad's for a couple of weeks. What embarrassing thing is that when I first started to watch football, my dad used to lift us over the terraces in Goodison. We used to be able to do that, and Danny's dad was in the team. That's how old I am, and I remember Danny's dad playing. So that's good, and obviously you have to find your own way, your own path. But injuries played a big part, did they, early on?
Yeah. So I was a young player. I was in my early 20s, and up until that point, I'd not had an injury.
Yeah,
and then I dislocated one of my ankles, and within about 6 months or a year I broke my other ankle, and I knew in that moment that it was the end of my dream.
Yeah.
And I was lying in my bed all day crying, and I got that out of my system, and then I thought about what am I going to do next, and to be honest I didn't have a clue. And it took me a long, long time, many, many years, to get to what I feel like is the most important part of my life, and that is the work that I'm doing now.
Yeah. Yeah, so you shifted from kind of being an athlete yourself to actually moving into a position where then you helped athletes.
Yeah.
And so what did that transition look? Was it immediate, Danny? Was it just a case of you said you got it out of your system? And I really appreciate the vulnerability. Was it a kind of, okay, well, what do I do now? I'm going to do this.
No, not at all.
Right.
So I'd been to uni before I became a professional, and luckily I'd done physio at uni.
Mm.
So at the time, that was the only thing you could do at uni connected to football.
Okay.
And my dad had always had strong bonds with physios, so I think he kind of influenced me to do that. And I did physio and had felt no connection to it. I didn't feel like I identified as a physio ever, which is strange because I did it for many years. But at that point, I decided I wanted to go and experience a different culture. So I moved to Manhattan and I lived there for 2 years and worked as a physio.
Mm.
And it was a great life-changing experience in terms of living in Manhattan. But the physio part of it, I didn't really enjoy.
Okay.
And then I came back home and I was like, right, well, what can I do now? And the only thing that I kind of knew what to do was to be a physio on a football team. So I started working for Sunderland, and that was a disaster. You know, we speak about culture a lot.
Yeah.
It was a very particular culture there. And people didn't really know anything about culture then. I mean, a lot don't now, but back then it was very particular culture. And it didn't work out. I was there about 6 months. And then I found my way into working at Everton. And I remember my first day there, I went into the kit room, and the kit room was a big place. Like, you go into this place and it's a challenge. So I went in and there was 6 or 7 kit men in there. And I walked out and I could hear one of them say, "He won't last 5 minutes, that one." So with this ringing in my ears, I go and start my day's work. And I ended up being there for about, I don't know, 16 years, something like that.
Wow.
So he was wrong.
Yeah, he was wrong. But what I find interesting, and obviously we'll get on and talk about this shortly in terms of culture in sports, but it was something that you recognised really early on, is that actually this is not the place for me. And sports did have a very particular culture, and in many respects it's still prevalent in many areas. But there was that early recognition in your early 20s, something I've talked about in the past, is I recognised when I have that sense of discomfort as well as comfort.
Yeah.
And that recognition that it's up to me to do something about it. Either I work to change it, yeah, or I get to the point where I don't feel that I can and I have to move on. Is that how you felt?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think, you know, you get that sense, don't you? You get that feeling in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And I help people now connect with those feelings more, because quite often people are in their heads and they get disconnected from the body. But everybody's got that sixth sense, and we all know. And the more you can tune into these feelings, the more peaceful and flow we're in life.
Yeah, and we appreciate that more. We're talking about mental health. We're thinking about inner calm. We're really concerned with kind of athlete progression, not just physical but mental too. Did that exist much back then? Was it all blood and thunder as I remember it? You know, people with blood on their shirts, and you know,
it was a bit like that.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the experience I had as a young boy is like, from when I was born, my dad used to meditate twice a day, all day, and that was in the 70s, and he used to read books like the Bhagavad Gita. He'd read books like the Gita on like the team coach, and all the other players, yeah, would be getting pissed and playing cards and stuff like that. So I had that influence. And then when I was working at Everton in those early days, I think it was less prevalent, it was less talked about. But there was more of a connectedness amongst players, and there was more of a collaborative culture that was there naturally.
Yeah.
And that seems to have got lost a little bit these days, where it's more sort of individual centric.
Yeah.
Each player now has their own team of people around them. And I think that's to do with the anxiety now of, like, it's more difficult. There's more pressure, more social media, stuff like that. But there's something missing, because the best part about being a footballer, being in sport, is having that connection with your teammates.
Yeah.
And it's one of the closest bonds you'll have. And I've got very good friends now from those early days at Everton, and they'll be lifelong friends.
Yeah. And it's something you hear ex-players talk a lot about, is they miss the camaraderie of the dressing room. They miss those connections with other players. So you had a good stint at Everton, then you went away. Is that when you did go to, you went to Aston Villa?
Yeah, I was at Aston Villa for about 2 years, and that was a great experience because it was at the time they were in the Championship and they'd been through like 10 years of hell, basically, underperforming, different culture changes. So our remit was to change the culture and get back into the Premier League really quickly. Mm-hmm. But that didn't quite happen. I got the opportunity to come back to Everton before they got back up.
Yeah.
But I was working with Steve Bruce at the time, and he's a really great guy, really great manager, who's really great at creating good cultures.
Right.
So I enjoyed that experience.
And Steve Bruce, of course, was part of a really successful Man United culture. Yeah. So I imagine there's lots that he took from that. And, you know, one of the things we talked about on the podcast is you really learn from the great people that you have around you. So all of this time that you're progressing through different teams, obviously different managers, you know, that time at Everton, I speak from experience, it definitely wasn't one manager all the time you spent at Everton. But you'll learn the good and the bad from the different people that you interact with, the different people that you work with. Is this something that you're absorbing and you're thinking, right, if, you know, kind of when I work with people, I want to do a bit of this, but not so much of this?
Yeah, you're absorbing that all the time. And I got very curious early on about, like, what actually makes a team successful, you know? And we've spoken today a lot about different managers and stuff like that, and even though I didn't realize it so much, David Moyes was really good at creating a culture. And you say we had a lot of managers, we did, but David Moyes was there for 12 years.
He was, yeah,
very consistent.
Yeah, yeah.
And at first I was a little bit unsure about him because he's very strict. But he did lots of little things to help create that collaboration and create that connection, which we all know is the foundation of culture, really.
Yeah, and it's
performance.
It's the glue. It's the glue that keeps things together. I talk a lot about, and I've talked on the podcast about micro experiences. It's the little things that you do. Now, of course, the challenge for managers in sports teams and managers anywhere is that you've got to be consistent with those micro experiences. As soon as you stop, that's when the culture kind of starts to stagnate. And so as you moved into working for yourself and you start to work with athletes, obviously you're focused on helping them with their own performance, their own thinking, but also are there elements culturally that you can introduce to say, oh, here's something that you can do to be a better teammate? Does it embody all those kind of things? It's selling your company.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good advert. Now over to our sponsors. Yeah, that's very relevant. Like, it's more about how I can help them and they can help me be a better human being. And a lot, like some of the players I work with are younger players, and I'm helping them develop into leaders. How do they become better leaders, and how do they help the culture and the teams that they're in? Mm-hmm. And then I've got older players who are coming to the end of their careers, and there's that transition, and helping them, how do they move through that phase of their career, which is very difficult and challenging, because you spend your whole life in this cocoon of football and you feel like that's normal life and you're used to it, and then all of a sudden one moment it ends. Mm-hmm. And for me, it ended in that moment when I knew that my injuries had stopped me. Mm-hmm. But for all footballers, it's a big moment, and to help them through that is a privilege, really. Mm-hmm. And you know, they can help younger players, and they can go into all different cultures and do different things. So it's about helping them explore that.
Yeah, it's something that I wrote about, I think.
You write about everything.
I do write about everything. Yeah, it's a good start. Children's book, that's the only thing I haven't done. Has anything really done a book on wizards? I can do that. One of the things I wrote about was the fact that there's an incredible amount of pressure on sports, on players in sports, and we forget that they're human beings just like everybody else. They have vulnerabilities just like everybody else. They have doubt just like everybody else. Listen, they have weaknesses and they have habits and they have vices that they want to break just like everybody else. But I think there's a constant pressure for them to perform, and that must eat away at them. That must...
Yeah. You know, Yeah, I think it's not talked about enough. And players themselves, when they're current players, they very rarely speak about this because they have to pretend to be this perfect, robotic, superhuman, which they're not. And I heard Novak Djokovic speaking this week about how he may look like he's calm and serene in every game, but the reality is that there's a war going on inside of him. And the war is, the biggest war is always with yourself. And Tim Howard was on my podcast and he spoke about, he said that him and Roy Keane had spoken and they said that you win a game on a Saturday and you feel relief for a few hours. And then the next day you realize that you're playing Chelsea away the next Saturday and that anxiety begins to build and it builds and builds throughout the week. And you have to find a way of being able to perform through this anxiety and then you've got a couple of hours relief and it goes again and again and again.
Yeah.
And the top players now, they play every 3 days. And it's, you know, everybody knows as the best thing for an athlete is to have something else in their life. So their identity isn't all just about being an athlete. So it's not everything about being an athlete.
Mm.
But for top footballers, for top baseball players, for top basketball players, it's impossible.
That's right.
Because they're playing every 3 days.
That's right.
Or baseball players every day.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's impossible to have a different part of your identity. And that leads to all kinds of things like addiction, depression, anxiety that doesn't really get spoken about.
It doesn't get spoken about, and it's great that people like you and others in your field are there to help them. It's interesting, I was talking to a friend recently, he said, have you seen the David Beckham documentary? Which of course I have. I really like David Beckham as a player, and he's a style icon for me. But what was interesting, I said, did you enjoy it? He's like, yeah. He said, I really saw him as a human. I'm like, as opposed to what? And I think he's like, oh, that's a really good question. I was like, he's still a human being. Like Roy Keane would say, well, he's just doing his job, isn't he? but he's like, oh, yeah, I just saw him as a machine.
Yeah.
Just that for me was what it was all about. I was like, at the end of the day, I was vulnerable. All of these things, right? He's just a human being. And it's great that people like you are there to help him. Now, I mentioned that you're the co-founder of the Team Code.
Yay.
The other co-founder just happens to be me. Spoiler alert. And so we've struck a partnership over the last few months. We've written a white paper about calling for a change in culture and sports. And, you know, our belief is that things do need to change. That really sporting organisations, sporting federations, clubs aren't doing enough to really think about the cultures that they're creating. And it's still this differential. Now, you work with younger players. And so you've got this real insight into what they're looking for. What do they tell you? What are they looking for in the teams and in the federations that they're working with them for?
Well, I'm gonna do what Arnold Schwarzenegger says, and he says, you bridge your question, so you don't answer the question, you say what you want to say, and then I'll come back to your question.
Great, you're right. Here's the question you should have asked.
He doesn't
want
to say it. No, I just wanted to say that I saw you speak yesterday to an organization, and in the room of about 60 people, you asked them how many people here have experienced the toxic culture, and there was about 60 arms that went up.
That's right, yeah.
And my own experience of working in football, I've seen the great cultures, as I've mentioned, and I've seen the toxic cultures. And for me to experience that toxic culture, it had a big toll on me. It was really uncomfortable, really, like, I felt like I wasn't myself. So to know that experience exists, I don't want anybody else to have to go through that. And what we're talking about doing is helping organizations create positive cultures that are going to help teams and individuals perform and thrive and reach their potential. So that, coming to your question, the young players that I work with, as I said earlier, I feel like what they're really missing and what they really crave and what they really want is connection. And a lot of teams and clubs now, because the pressure is so high and it's all about winning this game, there's no time and no knowledge about how to create that connection. And I feel like that's what we've got here.
Yeah.
You know, we can help teams and clubs and federations do that and create a much brighter future for those young players that we're bringing into sport. And it's not only in football, it's in every sport. And as you know, there's been a lot written about all of these toxic cultures in different sports like gymnastics, ice hockey, all of them.
Yeah.
So that's what we want to change. And I feel like if we can do that, we can change the world.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's a lofty ambition. It's a stretch vision, But it's one that someone has to take on. We have to, you know, for me, it's about spreading the word. There's lots and lots of talk about culture, and lives are being ruined around the world in different organisations. And I get if you don't work in a sports organisation, like, oh, well, I've got it tough. Everybody does. We completely understand. We're not trying to say everyone's better or worse than anybody else. But what I would say in sports is that there isn't even the talk of building culture like there is in corporates. I work with lots of large, small corporates, medium-sized corporates, and they at least talk about vision, they talk about values, they talk about diversity and inclusion. You get that sometimes, the latter certainly at sports clubs, but there isn't this kind of structured approach to actually building culture, to defining the values of an organization, to be able to work with teams and say, okay, well, how do we live these values? Because these are really attractive now for younger players, millennials, Gen Z. They're looking at purpose, they're looking at vision, they're looking at, well, what is it that you're doing to not only give me a pathway to become a better player, but also a pathway to become a better human being as well, right?
Yeah. And I feel like exactly what you're saying, that there's probably a couple of clubs, maybe one club from the outside, like Brentford, for example, that is more clear in its values and more clear in its value statement. And surprise, surprise, they've got a track record of being ultra successful and also developing young players and developing them into whole, complete people.
That's right.
And clubs like that are the ones that are going to attract the best young talent, because they know that they can trust the culture and they're also going to become better players. So it's not only about mental health, it's about how can you perform alongside maintaining mental health, not at all costs, which it has been in the past.
It has been in the past, that's absolutely right. Now, we talk about the concept of winning cultures, and traditionally winning is seen as the results.
Yeah.
But winning is actually creating an environment where people feel safe to speak up, they feel able to be the best version of themselves, they're surrounded by people who want the best for them as well as for the team, and they have the discipline to perform. Now, that doesn't mean that you win every game. What that means is you continually build towards something. And actually, if you put time, thought and effort into building culture, and all of the research shows this, then eventually it will pay you back in results. Too often there's this need for immediate results, and whilst you may get a short-term lift, almost always it will return to kind of a fighting culture or even a stagnating culture where results aren't possible. And I think our goal, and something that we've talked about in the paper, is to really put the emphasis on winning at all costs is bad, but winning still has to be the goal. And it's about taking the time and the right steps to achieve that.
Yeah, it's about sustainable winning, isn't it?
Yeah,
and sustaining that over generations. So when the current CEO isn't there, when the current manager isn't there, it's sustainable and the culture is sustainable.
Yeah.
And I've been in many sports cultures where I don't think they even had values. They certainly weren't explicit and they certainly weren't clear for people within the organization what they were. So there's nothing to measure it against.
Mm.
And there's nothing to look towards. Whereas the best cultures, as you know, are very clear. All the evidence supports it, doesn't it?
All of the evidence. And what if, particularly the organisations, I'll come on to federations in a second, but when organisations take time to define the culture, it provides the foundation and the certainty for all employees. I think too often what happens in sports is that the culture changes with the coach, and it creates a whole level of uncertainty. Now, that's not to say that the coach or the manager brings their own ideas. That's what you expect. But ultimately, you want the culture to be the decider as to whether this manager fits what we're looking for.
Exactly.
What you want is to use the culture as a mechanism to recruit like-minded people,
yes,
such that you don't bring in a person that can influence the culture in a negative way.
Yeah.
Is the culture is the thing that has to continually exist, and the people that you bring in add to that. So you're added for it. It's a kind of a values add culture.
Yeah.
Now, federations, and just to finish on this, so this is governing bodies, is they've got a responsibility to make sure that they educate those people that are coming through as to what is culture, how do you build safe, sustainable, winning cultures in a way that doesn't affect mental health. So we don't have a, you know, kind of people who are continually anxious and depressed and actually enjoy and get a sense of fun out of what they do. You know, and I think really that's the responsibility of global bodies to make sure they have education programs like that to help the next generation of leaders, right?
Yeah. And what you said reminded me exactly. We spoke to Tim Cahill earlier today, and it's in line with exactly what he said. And he wants to, along with us, he wants to influence culture in that way. So we create a new generation of people that are thriving at work and are driven and don't feel depressed and anxious because they are well looked after. Their culture is good, strong and robust.
Yeah, and they're doing it in the right way.
Exactly.
Well, Danny, if you want to find out more, you can go to theteamcode.com. Danny, where can people find out more about you?
Theteamcode.com.
And of course on LinkedIn, Danny Donoghue.
And Linkbodyism.
Which we'll share the links in the podcast. But Danny, thank you so much for joining us today on the Culture Makers Morning podcast.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Colin.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the link with your colleagues and friends or with your connections on social media. If you'd like to find out more about the work that I do, head to www.colindellis.com or find me on LinkedIn.